Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the third oral argument via WebEx we have before us this morning. I would note that while Judge Hutton is a member of this panel, she is ill today. So she will be listening to our oral arguments on tape, and then after she listens to them, the panel will conference the case and come to our decision. As if you were in our physical courtroom, each side will have 15 minutes for their argument. Counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please say your name at the beginning of when you talk so that that is clear for our audio recording. And if during your presentation your screen freezes or you have any technological difficulties, just let us know. We can add additional time while we get that addressed. We want to make sure we are able to hear from both of you so that we have the best understanding of this case. The timekeeper is keeping track of time on the screen, so hopefully you can see that. And with that, counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Seth Zawilla, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellant. May it please the court. This appeal is fundamentally about the lower district court conflating Mr. and Mrs. Ingersoll's behaviors, issues of comparative fault with a strict doctrine of superseding cause. Under the law, superseding cause's four elements must all be strictly met in order to completely immunize an originally negligent tortfeasor from any liability. And specifically, superseding cause requires that the superseding act must not have arisen from the original negligence, and that the superseding act must not be foreseeable to the originally negligent tortfeasor. Here in this case, at the summary judgment stage, this court must accept the following facts as true. First, the fact that the physician's assistant knew and was well aware that Mr. Ingersoll was addicted to opioids and had a potential and an inclination to abuse his medication, and two, that his wife, Mrs. Ingersoll, was not in control of his behavior. And underlying all of this, driving the heart of this appeal, is that the physician's assistant's originally negligent act was a negligent miscalculation and a massive overdose, a prescription of an overdose of methadone, nearly five times the morphine equivalent of the correct dosage, which played a direct and substantial role in Mr. Ingersoll's death. And that's a consequence that the fact record shows that more likely than not would have occurred if you completely removed Mr. and Mrs. Ingersoll's behaviors out of the equation completely. And so the ultimate question of who's at fault and how to apportion that fault is fundamentally a question for the jury. It is not a question for the district court to superimpose its analysis via the blunt and high tool of superseding cause into this analysis.
Well, one question I have for you is, what do we do with the district court, Mr. Remick's determination that an agreement did exist between the wife and the physician's assistant on administering or protecting him from the drugs? I mean, we have a specific finding that says that. How do we step around that?
So I think the way you step around that is saying that is a question that is up for debate. As has been briefed in both briefs, the fact record is not clear, and I would argue very clearly shows that there was not an agreement. If you look at Mrs. Ingersoll's deposition, she consistently states multiple times there was no agreement, and there's considerate ambiguity if you look at the medical record. And for the court as a matter of law to say this is not up for question, it has to meet a very high standard that no reasonable mind could disagree. And here, given the rich and ambiguous facts in the records, that's just simply not the case. And even if there was,
you think the district court judge was weighing credibility on that determination?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's potential, but I believe that the question is not, it's the question of what a reasonable mind and what a juror could decide. And so in this review at the summary judgment stage, the court must review it in a light most favorable to the appellant and assuming these facts is true. And here whether we believe Mrs. Ingersoll or not, or whether we believe the ambiguity in the record, that's fundamentally a question for a jury to decide. And on top of that, I would say, even if you accept the fact that there was some sort of agreement there, it still doesn't satisfy superseding causes four elements, and specifically the three elements at contest in this appeal.
Thank you.
And so basically, you know, one thing I'd like to kind of really highlight here that I think is very significant is on the third element that we're discussing, the question of that it must have turned, that the superseding act must have turned aside the natural course of events. I think the fundamental point here is that there is evidence in the record via the expert affidavit that we have, an extensive affidavit that says that Mr. Ingersoll, had he taken the medication as prescribed and as directed, which we argue is what happened, and there's credible evidence to show that's the case, that if a juror could decide that, he would have ultimately died. And so as a result, that eliminates superseding cause as an element and makes Mr. and Mrs. Ingersoll's behaviors mere events rather than conditions or causation chains. And so I think that's first very important that we all remember. And then on top of that, even if you don't accept that argument, I think it's also a very important and salient point that under the restatement of torts and throughout the case law, a superseding cause needs, or a superseding cause's consequence needs to be distinct and unique from the originally negligent act in order to afford this extraordinary remedy. Right? That is superseding cause. And if you look at the Schiebel versus Illinois Farmer case before the Minnesota Supreme Court that's been briefed, I want to read a quote here that I think is very important. Quote, "It would be an absurd result to cut off recovery for an injury from the first accident merely because an intervening accident aggravates the same injury." And in this case, that same injury is an overdose of methadone. It's the exact same consequence, and it's the negligence that was set into the world when the physician's assistant negligently calculated this overdose of methadone, which according to our expert is a reckless disregard for patient safety, being five times the morphine equivalent. That's correct. And so given that, I also encourage for this court as well to look at the Harrington versus Regina Medicine case that it decided in 2004, where it analyzed superseding cause in a medical malpractice context and found against it, commenting, and I'm going to quote here, "Indeed, the superseding negligence produced the same result that the original tortfeasor's alleged negligence produced, death by myocarditis," end quote, so, which was what was in that case.
Counsel, I'm glad you brought up that case, because I wanted to turn to what precedent we have in this state where we're talking about medical malpractice cases and the issue of superseding cause. Because, and maybe that is one that when I looked at this, I just didn't see one where the courts had ever affirmed a district court that issued summary judgment for the defendant based upon superseding cause, as opposed to looking and saying, look, is a jury instruction appropriate here? Should this go to the jury? Am I right about that? What is the closest case that we have in Minnesota? Because I realize in superseding causes cases, a lot of them are product cases, and that's a little different.
Yeah. Well, Your Honor, I think that's a really good point. I think if you look at the case law, and the case law that's been cited by the respondent, for example, the Altman's versus orthopedic case, Kornfeld versus Tongan, these are not questioned and analyzed at the summary judgment stage. They're either analyzing a jury instruction or in the post verdict post-trial stage. And those are fundamentally different analyses. And in addition to your answer to your question, I personally think the Harrington case is the most on point because it analyzes a very similar situation, which is medical malpractice in this context. And it finds that the ultimate harm that the superseding cause created is the exact same harm that was put into place by the originally negligent tortfeasor. And this is evidence not only in Minnesota's case law, this is the common law itself. And that's clearly articulated in the second restatement. And it's such an important factor that in the third restatement of torts, it's the only factor that's relevant because they greatly reduced it and greatly simplified what is a superseding act and simply said it must not be a unique, or it must be a unique harm.
I saw that you spent a lot of your reply brief talking about the restatement, but as I understand it, we don't have Minnesota appellate courts have adopted the third restatement in this area. Is that fair to say?
I think that's right. I think that my understanding of the case law is that the Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court have frequently turned to the restatement as a persuasive authority, and in some cases have explicitly adopted it. And so I would point this court to the Robinson case, for example, in the example of the second restatement, where it analyzes those factors, you know, to great effect in making its analysis. And I would encourage for this court to do the same, given the persuasive applicableness of the restatement.
Counsel, when we look at this fourth, is it element or condition? You can fill me in on your thoughts about that. When we're looking at superseding, whether a cause is a superseding cause, you know, that's about foreseeability, right? Really, as I look at it, correct me if I'm wrong, the third and fourth considerations are both really related to foreseeability. Shouldn't we be, you know, looking at kind of the Minnesota Supreme Court's recent decisions? There have been quite a few of them about foreseeability. When it's close, it goes to the jury. I mean, is there any reason that those cases, and I'm going to ask both of you all to address that, those that we shouldn't be looking to those cases for guidance, even though they're not specifically dealing with superseding causes?
I think that it's a fair point you raise, Your Honor. I think that fundamentally, beyond the doctrine of superseding cause, this is really a question of what is a fair fact question that should go to the jury. And as the appellant in this circumstance, I understand and I appreciate the standard and why it is there. And that is to set aside cases that there are clearly no fact questions. However, the right to a jury trial is so fundamental and so important that there has to be a lot of evidence there showing that no reasonable mind would disagree. And that's the fundamental question that this precedent, the recent precedent, is analyzing, grappling with. And I would encourage for this court, if it feels it's appropriate to look to that precedent, to look to it as for such. Would you like me to get into the fourth element as well, or?
It's your argument.
Okay, all right, thank you. Well, yeah, no, on that fourth element, I would say that it was highly foreseeable in this circumstance. And something that I think is important that the court understand is that the question is not the specific mechanism must be foreseeable. I know that the respondent has made an issue that, hey, it seems as if their interpretation of the record that the wife willingly handed over the medication without there being a struggle. First, we don't think that's the case. Our review of the record is that there was a struggle. And second, the law is that it is the ultimate risk that must be foreseeable. And here that risk is that Mr. Ingersoll would abuse his methadone and would not take it as prescribed. And we would say that's highly likely to occur in this circumstance. As the physician's assistant said directly in her appeal, when directly asked about this, she testified that this was an obvious risk that he would abuse his medication and that he had the potential to misuse it and that she was worried about him. And that's compounded additionally by the fact she wrote in the medical record, he has taken his wife's medication, which is a pretty rare finding to find in the medical record, you know, for in medical malpractice cases.
Was there anything in the record? I don't see where this court even discussed the recommended safe dose. I know your expert made an opinion on that, but was that in the record at all?
I believe it was, Your Honor. And I think that it was explicitly in the record and was raised in the summary judgment briefing. So, for example, I'd like to point the court to the respondent summary judgment reply brief at pages 5 through 7, and I'm going to read a quote excerpt from there. It says, quote, plaintiff asserts that her expert will testify that, in his opinion, Mr. Ingersoll would have ingested a lethal amount of methadone even if he had taken it as directed, end quote. And so I believe that clearly that is part of the record here that this court should be reviewing. And on top of that, if you look to the expert affidavit on page or on paragraph 107, I'm going to read the explicit quote here. Quote, if Wallen Quinlan had calculated and prescribed the appropriate dose of methadone, Thomas Ingersoll more likely than not would be alive today, end quote. And so as a basis for this, we think
that was your expert. Was that quote?
That was the direct expert.
Thank you.
That's paragraph 107 in our expert affidavit. And I think that's a very frank quote. And even if you may have some ambiguity and say, you know, I don't know if I fully accept that, I would encourage for this court to remember that these expert affidavits required in medical malpractice cases are not meant to literally try the case before trial. And that's emphasized again and again in this court's precedent. And they're supposed to give the basis of fact to a reasonable degree and give the basis of their opinions. And here, you know, that's clearly the case, and that's clearly what our expert is opined to. And you know, I think that alone, in my opinion, makes this subject to reverse and remand to the district court. These are questions that a jury needs to decide. They're complex, they're ambiguous. You know, I'm not going to pretend as if this is a completely clear record, right, for the appellant. However, these are completely important questions for a jury fundamentally decide, not for the district court to superimpose, you know, superseding cause into at the summary judgment stage. And so, you know, unless there are additional questions, I'd like to continue on, you know, with my analysis. I think that in addition, on the second element of superseding cause, I know that there's been a bit of a debate of whether if an act is simply not normal, whether that will qualify it as a superseding cause alone. You know, I think the important analysis there is that the question is not what is simply abnormal or out of the ordinary, rather it is what is extraordinary and out of the everyday. And that's illustrated, for example, by examples of, you know, a bolt of lightning or something completely coming out of the blue, rather than what is a reasonably expected reaction to stimulus, which is the originally negligent act. And if you look at the Robinson case, which is decided by the Minnesota Supreme Court, they direct these courts to view this question of what is an extraordinary response, quote, in view of the circumstances existing at the time of its operation, end quote. And so so that is an objective factual analysis of what a reasonable person would consider are those circumstances at that time. And when you review the record, if you look at Mrs. Ingersoll's deposition and the physician's assistant's deposition, it is abundantly clear that Mrs. Ingersoll was never in control of the ability to control her husband's behavior and his addiction to methadone.
Your time is up. You'll have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. And if I may, I'm not sure that I gave the name and file number of this case when we began our argument. I apologize for that. But this is, for those listening, Carmen Michelle Ingersoll versus Innovus Health, A19-1813. And with that, counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Julian Ehrengarten. I am here representing respondent Innovus Health. And I'd like to just start out by reminding the court what Wartnick versus Moss and Barnett tells us about the doctrine of superseding cause, which is that it recognizes that although an actor's negligent actions may have put the plaintiff in a position to be injured and therefore contributed to the injury, the actual injury may have been caused by an intervening event. And that intervention prevents the original negligent actor from being liable for the final injury. And when a superseding intervening cause exists, case law tells us that if that breaks the chain of causation set in operation by the defendant's negligence and thereby insulates his negligence as a direct cause of the injury, rendering it essentially an occasion or condition but not a proximate cause of the injury.
Counsel, in this case, I understand all that, but why isn't that an issue for the jury to decide?
Well, because ordinarily it would be, but the thing about intervening superseding cause cases, just like with negligence in general, is that it's not easy to define, and there is no particular, you know, hard and fast measurement by which you determine whether a superseding intervening cause exists, and each case must be more or less examined on its own facts. And when you look at the facts in this case,
counsel, if it's not easy to define, why isn't that something that we ask a jury to do? If there are no hard and fast rules, it's not easy to define. That sounds like exactly the type of situation where we say, and that's for the jury.
Well, again, ordinarily that would be the case, but in some circumstances, such as the ones in this case, the unique facts of the situation warrant application of intervening superseding cause as a matter of law, because the facts demonstrate that while, again, as Wartnick says, while the plaintiff may have been put into a position of being injured and by the actions of the defendant, the actual injury was caused by an intervening event. And that's why it's so important in this case that we look at the facts as Wallen Quinlan knew them at the time she made this prescription. And that is the standard by which we are told we have to analyze the superseding intervening cause defense. You can't take the record and look at all of the hindsight facts that we've learned. You have to look at what she knew when she made that prescription. And what she knew when she made that prescription was that the Ingersolls were attending this May 30th appointment with her. It had been specifically scheduled by Mrs. Ingersoll. And the purpose of that meeting, that appointment, was to discuss Mr. Ingersoll's opioid use and his desire to get off his opioid medication. And during this meeting, they lay it all out for Ms. Wallen Quinlan. They appear to be very candid with her about his overuse and his misuse of his medication, but they notably don't tell her certain facts. For instance, that he had this habit of snorting his opioids. Our physician's assistant, Ms. Wallen Quinlan, initially recommends that Mr. Ingersoll enter a treatment center to assist him with achieving the goal of getting off the opioids, but he refuses. So this puts her in a situation where she needs to do something for her patient, but restricted by her unwillingness.
She could have sought counsel with a pain specialist. She could have referred him to people who specialize in this. I mean, typically, as you know, morphine is often dispensed in clinic settings, often where people have to come almost every day where they're at risk of addiction. I mean, even if we take your approach and look at what's happening when she knows it, I find it hard to say that then as a matter of law, we have superseding cause.
Well, so she's in this position where it's a Friday morning. They're about to go in to a weekend where he has no medication at all. And he has not only does he have a problem with the opioids, but he also has a chronic pain condition. So this is sort of a double-edged sword because she can't.
Ms. Nierengarten, going back to when you were narrating the facts that led up to the meeting with husband and wife, you said that they didn't disclose that he would snort. Was there any evidence that snorting this medication, was there any evidence at all presented that snorting this medication could have, in fact, lead to an overdose?
Well, the reason that the snorting the medication information is important, specifically with respect to Carmen Ingersoll's failure to essentially follow through on her agreement to secure the medication, is because that piece of information.
Now you brought up the other question, and I understand from appellate counsel that that's disputed, that she was going to be monitoring his medication. I mean, we have a summary judgment decision, and that's what troubles me, is that even with us, I feel as if we're weighing evidence between what you're arguing and what appellant counsel Mr. Zawilla is arguing.
I understand. It's a complicated situation. It is a difficult decision to make on these particular facts. But I would dispute counsel's characterization of the record on Ms. Ingersoll's testimony regarding the agreement. She testifies extensively about the appointment and about whether she made this agreement and whether she had the capability of locking up the methadone. And ultimately her testimony on this is not, no, I did not agree to this. Her testimony is, and this is on page 64 of her deposition, they're talking about when Ms. Wallen Quinlan asked her whether she had a lockbox that she could keep this medication in. She's asked, what did you say in response to this question? And she said, I said, what could I say? What could I say? The next question is, did you tell her you didn't have a lockbox? No, I didn't. Next question is, okay, did you tell her that you'd keep it in a lockbox? I might have, I'm not sure. That's her testimony. The contemporary evidence in the record, in the medical record, is that they had a discussion about this and Ms. Ingersoll agreed to lock up the methadone. Whether or not she had the capability, she told the physician's assistant that she could and would do that.
So,
and when she tells the physician that she could and would do that, and they have omitted critical information about the means and manner of Mr. Ingersoll's abuse of his medication, it puts our medical professional in a position of believing, because she's been presented with this information in a very candid and seemingly expansive manner, that she has the necessary information to know that it is possible and safe to prescribe him a methadone prescription.
So, Ms. Herengarten, earlier, just in answering Judge Werke's question, you said that you acknowledge that this is a difficult decision to make on these facts. So going back to a question I asked appellant's counsel, why wouldn't we, because foreseeability is, you know, an element here on superseding cause, why wouldn't we look to the Supreme Court's recent decisions in the negligence area that say when it's a close call on foreseeability, it goes to the jury? Why wouldn't we, just with your admission, it's a difficult decision to make on these facts, say, and this one should have gone to the jury?
Let me clarify a little bit what I mean when I say it's a difficult decision to make on these facts. This is not an uplifting case. These facts are difficult to read. We're dealing with a patient who ultimately died of an overdose. You know, this is a difficult situation to find yourself in, particularly when you're talking about granting summary judgment against the plaintiff and on these, with this background information, for essentially what happened. But our position is and always has been that the information that Ms. Wallen-Crinlin had at the time that she made this prescription, which is, of course, the allegedly negligent act, that based on that information, it's not a close call about whether it was foreseeable. That, and I'm talking specifically in this instance about Ms. Ingersoll's decision to simply hand her husband this prescription and walk away. And not just leave him to have the prescription, but leave him alone in the house with the prescription for the weekend. She returned, you know, for sleeping, but generally her testimony is that she was, out of the house for the majority of the weekend. And there, based on the facts as Ms. Wallen-Crinlin knew them when she made that prescription, which indicated to her that Carmen Ingersoll was invested in seeing her husband get off these opioids. She wanted him to essentially move on from this point in his life. She wanted her husband back. She had
Counsel, if I may, you're saying to us that the wife's actions or lack of actions, that is primarily the superseding cause here. And I just find that hard to grapple with on summary judgment in a medical malpractice case, where at least I've seen it, and point me to cases that you think dispute this, where it's been, well, after some initial perhaps negligence, the plaintiff ended up seeing another doctor, was it involved at another hospital, that there was something, some other intervention by the medical community in some ways, as opposed to the patient or his wife did or didn't do something. So what's the most analogous case to dissuade me from that position?
Well, I agree that we don't have good analogous case law. And a large reason for that is because, as you know, I was discussing earlier, every superseding intervening cause is based on its own case. Every superseding intervening cause case is based on its own individual facts. And these are the individual facts that we have here. And they are extraordinary in as much as Ms. Ingersoll essentially inserted herself into the situation. She, you know, if we were talking about, if this were a situation where, for instance, Mr. Ingersoll had met alone with Ms. Wallen-Crinlin, he had asked her if his wife had a lockbox that she could secure it in. He said yes. He takes the prescription home, either does or doesn't tell his wife, and then she doesn't do what the medical professional thought she would do. We're not here talking about intervening superseding cause here. In this case, Ms. Ingersoll has made a point of giving an appearance that she is capable and willing and that invested in essentially helping Mr. Ingersoll take his medication as prescribed. And so when we look at those facts as laid out at the time Ms. Wallen-Crinlin made that prescription, it is not foreseeable to her that a woman who gives every appearance of being invested in his recovery and wants him to get off these opioids and wants her husband back, as she testifies, that she would then walk home, she would fill the prescription, and then as soon as they walked in the door, she would hand him the medication and leave for the weekend. And I want to clarify one point on that. Counsel for plaintiff says that she didn't hand him, that it was coercive. And the record simply does not reflect that. I mean, her testimony on the point of him, of when he received the medication simply doesn't demonstrate a coercive interaction.
I just get one thing clarified here, if I may, counsel. So you're talking about wife's actions or inactions being a superseding cause because, from your perspective, she inserted herself into the interaction, into the situation. But then if that's the case, and so we ought to give that some pause, then that would not be true about what I understand is the third superseding cause pursuant to the district court's order, and that's the husband's snorting of medication. I mean, is that fair to say? That rationale does not apply to the husband's actions.
I would say that the same rationale does not apply to the husband's action, but I will point out for the court's benefit, although I know that you know this, you don't need to agree with the court on all three points of intervening superseding cause to affirm this decision. Agreeing with the court on one is sufficient.
I'm just trying to narrow it, counsel.
Yep, I understand that. And I just want to be clear on that. I also want to point out for the court that there's much made of plaintiff's expert's report and the opinion on, the causation and all this stuff. I would like to point out for the court that in paragraph 108 of plaintiff's expert's report, he offers the opinion that Mr. Ingersoll took more methadone than prescribed and that this caused him to fatally overdose on the methadone. The only reason that he was able to take more methadone than prescribed, which is, of course, what's written on the bottle for him to take, is because Mrs. Ingersoll had told Ms. Wallen-Quinlan that she would secure and administer this methadone, and then instead of doing that, she handed it over to Mr. Ingersoll to manage by himself.
Ms. That's the end of your argument, but you indicated that we only need to find one superseding intervening cause in order to affirm the district court. Is there any one of those that you feel is your strongest argument?
Yes, and it is this, the first one, that Ms. Ingersoll agreed to secure and manage the methadone prescription and then relinquished all control as soon as they got home. And again, there is evidence of that in her deposition. That is, I believe it's pages 74 through 76 that's discussed. I see my time is up. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think the important thing I want to highlight is with respondents' counsel's characterization of this record, she repeatedly throughout her argument referenced that it's complicated, not easy to define, not hard and fast measure. And fundamentally, at the end of the day, these are questions that belong with a jury. That's ultimately what it comes down to. And in terms of the in the weeds thicket and question of what's in the record, I openly invite this court to go and look at the record, which has been briefed back and forth extensively in the briefing, to review this extensive ambiguity. However, I'd like to take point with this issue of inaction and this issue of that apparently the wife, according to the respondent, affirmatively came forward and said, hey, I'll manage this medication, and that was somehow unforeseeable. I really want to highlight here that is just frankly not really the representation within the fact record. I'm going to read a couple of her deposition excerpts. Question, did you offer to manage his pain medication? Answer, no, am I supposed to? Question, and what else was discussed during that appointment? Answer, she gave him methadone and she told me to put it in a lockbox. Question, but where did this discussion of a lockbox come from? Answer, where did it come from? From her. And so the question here ultimately derives of whose testimony do you accept as fact? And that's fundamentally for a jury to decide. And I'll also point out that our expert opined extensively that this situation for the physician's assistant to affirmatively ask for a patient's family member to manage a methadone prescription was wholly inappropriate due to the unique properties of methadone. And frankly, if this court were to hold that that was a superseding act, you frankly could incentivize actions from healthcare providers to simply turn to a family member and say, hey, you're going to take part of this medication to insulate themselves from any liability that they may create. And so, you know, if you look at the record and really dig into it, you know, I think these questions are very open to debate, ambiguous. It's not a clear-cut case. And it's certainly not, you know, appropriate for the summary judgment stage, as has been evidenced back and forth with the briefing that's gone between the parties. And so, in addition, I'd like to also raise the point that Respondent's counsel brought up, where she referenced, I believe it was paragraph 108, where she says that the expert, our expert, opined that Mr. Ingersoll took more medication than he was supposed to. I want to importantly point out that that paragraph makes an argument in the alternative. And that's evidenced by the fact how he later says, I believe it's immediately after in the paragraph that I cited earlier in my for opening argument, where he says, even had, you know, he taken the medication as prescribed, which is what we're arguing, he would have ultimately, you know, overdosed in any event. And that, I think, fundamentally gets to this point that there is reason, there are a plethora of facts in this record for a reasonable juror to conclude that this is, does not rise to the extraordinary level of superseding cause, and that this is fundamentally a question for a jury to decide. And the additional item I really want to point out as well is the respondent in her argument said that we need to look at the facts of only what the physician's assistant knew at that time. And I've got, I think I have two responses to that. My first response is, I don't really think that's strictly the case for the first element. If you look at the Robinson case that's cited, that has been cited in this brief at the Minnesota Supreme Court, and you look to the restatement of torts, you have to view these facts objectively in the circumstances as they existed in the time. And I'm asserting the argument, and I believe this is the law, that you have to review the facts throughout the record that a juror is considering to understand this question of did it arise from the original negligence, because you have to understand all of the facts that are happening to fully evaluate that stimuli. And then the next item I'd like to say, in her point that she was making about that, you know, the physician's assistant, there's no way, you know, that she could tell that Mr. Ingersoll would go home and abuse this methadone, I think that that just plainly conflicts with the record. If you look at her deposition, I'm going to read a quote here. Quote, so obviously it's a concern, and obviously I discussed it with him because the records show so, and obviously I was concerned about him, end quote. And that's her response directly when she's confronted with this question. And I think it's very clear that a struggling addict of many years was at risk of abusing his methadone prescription. And that's identified explicitly in the medical record, where she herself, the physician's assistant, writes down he admits to stealing his wife's medication. And so it shows clearly that that's what's in the record. And so, Your Honor, I believe that my time is coming up. I'd like to open, if you have any follow-up questions, you know, to end.
Any questions, Judge Warkey?
I have none, but I would like to comment on your excellent briefing and arguments today.
Thank you for listening, Your Honor.
Both of your arguments and briefs were very helpful to the panel. We will take the matter under consideration. An opinion will be issued within 90 days. And as at the end of this third oral argument of the morning, the court is now in recess.